All right then, how are we all today? So I have two missions today. One of them is to obviously talk to you about Virtualizing Exchange 2013, and one, to help you have a good time so when you get on the bus, you'll be good to go for the event tonight. So they're my two missions. Tell me if I am successful. All righty, we've got a few things we want to cover today. The first thing I want to do is just introduction so we can, you know who I am and I know who you are, so I can hopefully tune the content to suit what you guys are currently doing. I want to talk about why we're here. There's some things that have obviously changed with the release of Exchange 2013 that you need to understand in terms of virtualization. So we'll cover that off and about why you want to do it, etc. I thought as a bit of interest, a little history lesson around Exchange. It's in its eighth version, and what I say, it's third generation. That's pretty extraordinary, I think. So I just want to run through that a little, just as a matter of interest in that. And that's really to bring us to where we are today and why we want to have that discussion. I'm going to cover off the things you need to think about when you're going to virtualize Exchange. Some of those things, I've got to say, are blindly obvious. Some of those things aren't. And some of those things have recently changed with hypervisor technology and certainly with Windows Server 2012 coming out. You know, I think some of the rules have changed. So we'll cover that off. And then the last bit, which we'll spend a little bit of time on, I think, around avoiding issues. In my life as an Exchange person, I often see people make some pretty simple mistakes, and ultimately that ends up in a bad experience for users, which is something I think we should, you know, go out of our way to avoid. And that's a bit of what this talk's about, really, how to avoid that landmine, that unhappy customer, etc., etc. So that's where we're going to go with that. And finally, just a quick wrap-up and summary. Hopefully we'll have a bit of Q&A at the end. I suspect with everyone's motivation to go that way at the end of the session, that might be not too many questions. But if we don't manage to do that because people are leaving, just please come to the front and I'll see what I can do to help. I think the buses get underway about 6:15. Is that right? 6:15? Anyone? Okay, cool. All right. So who am I? My name's Sandy Miller. I work for Avanade in Canberra, and I noticed some of my Canberra colleagues here today, which is great. I've been working with Exchange for a long time, in fact, from version 4. In that time, I've done countless projects implementing Exchange, migrating off other platforms, any number of different things, fixing it on occasions. I don't typically do that, but I've been called in on a couple of really ugly large deployment failures and operational failures. The most interesting one was actually 2 million mailboxes back on Exchange 2003. So any of you with Exchange 2003 experience will know that 2 million is a pretty awkward number, but that was interesting. I'm an Exchange certified master and Exchange certified architect, and for folks who don't know what that is, I'll say it was until last week Microsoft's premier top qualification certification for various technologies. It's also AD and SharePoint and such. So I've been doing that for a long time as well, since 2006 in fact, so that gets me involved in a lot of interesting things. Currently, I'm working on a global Office 365 implementation. It's an interesting one because the customer is consolidating 3 separate Active Directory forests into 1 tenant. So that brings all sorts of interesting complexities and challenges with it. So what about you guys? What do you guys do? So who in here manages Exchange platforms? Wow, fantastic. What about who designs Exchange solutions? A few? Excellent. So let's have a quick competition. Who's got the biggest Exchange platform at the moment in Australia? Out of you guys. Start yelling out some numbers. Seats, mailboxes. 1,500? 65,000 over here? Are you the winner? Telstra, 65, you are the winner. I have prizes for winners today. This beautiful limited edition, this is one of at least 250,000. Limited edition bad boy, this is for you. I'm going to ask some other questions through the presentation. This is the prize. If you want to come up and grab it now, and otherwise I'll just completely forget. It's quite an interesting poster. We'll have a look at this a little bit further into the presentation. There you go. Don't say I don't give you anything. All right. Who's deployed Exchange today? 2013. Couple? So was it a Greenfields or an upgrade?
Combination. I've done a few.
Done a few. Excellent. What about down the back there? Upgrade. Great. So no Greenfields. Actually, they're quite uncommon nowadays. Funnily enough, Exchange is actually quite popular. All right, who's done the certification? Anyone? Over here? Good on you. Down here? Excellent. I'm a real certification fan. As I said before, being MCM and MCA, that's not something that comes easy. It takes a lot of time and a lot of patience and a lot of crying. No crying. But yeah, I'm a big fan. I've actually been Microsoft certified for 20 years. I'm younger than I look. But yeah, so I'm a real fan. So good on you for doing that. That's excellent. And I encourage you all to do it for one reason alone. Exchange is a big product now. In fact, it's a huge product. It's got lots of moving parts. One of the ways to learn those and be proficient in making good decisions is actually having that knowledge. If you don't have that knowledge, you won't necessarily make good decisions. So I certainly encourage you to do that. All right, why are we here? I told you we'd answer that question. You know, obviously, there is a new version of Exchange 2013. Oh, of Exchange, I should say, 2013. It's different. It's changed. It's evolved some more. The architecture has certainly changed, down from 5-odd roles to 2. That has meant parts of and components have now moved around with those roles. That's going to change the characteristics of its performance and what it requires from the underpinning hardware. It's important for us, especially when you're considering virtualization, to spend a bit of time to think about that. Certainly the workload distribution, quite different. It can manage itself now in certain areas, and we'll talk about that. But also, too, I think, it's not like virtualization technology is on a standstill either. It's changing as well. In the last couple of years, some of the changes have been quite dramatic in virtualization and also the hardware that it runs on. A 256 gig server nowadays is probably not that unusual. 5 years ago, it would have been, you've got to be joking, about having one of those. So, got to think about those things. Also, too, with Exchange, the scalability requirements are changing. The early days with Exchange 4, for example, they were usually highly distributed. There were servers and branch offices, all of that sort of stuff. It was often gated by network capability. Not so much nowadays. More and more people are centralizing, if not in single, data centers with some failover data center capability, but they're certainly bringing it down and cutting down the number of servers with a drive to increasing the population per server. And that's been steadily going up over the years. So all in all, with all of that, we just have to revisit our thinking on it. Applying 2010 or 2007 thinking to Exchange 2013 is just not a good call. You need to revise it. And that's really what I want to talk about today. So I thought, as I said, we'll do a bit of a history lesson. 8th version, third generation. Exchange 4, did anyone ever deal with that? Anyone? A couple of people? It seems to me personally like a long time ago. And it was. It was, a long time ago. And, I helped you move a lot of people off Microsoft Mail. I don't know if anyone ever remembers that. Yeah, a few people. Yeah. It's funny, though. It's like, no offence, but it's the older looking guys. It was a long time ago. So, yeah. So that stuck around for a little while. And really, it opened the door. People saw the opportunity with messaging, moving away from, hey, I've got email, to, really looking seriously as a business tool and a business communication mechanism. And that's when it really started shifting. Followed up quickly with 5.0. Probably fair to say that it wasn't a thoroughly successful. It had a few problems, and Microsoft, good on them, changed that pretty quickly for 5.5. And this is when SMTP started becoming more popular. It was out there always, but a lot of organisations didn't have internet connections early on. They had what was known as an X400 connector, which were pretty complicated sort of old-fashioned style connectors and proprietary connectors, but really the internet technology started kicking in then. Plus, OWA started popping in about that time as well, people accessing their mail via a browser. 2000, which is really when, in my mind, Exchange really took off. It became integrated with Active Directory. I'm sure you're all aware of that. But it really, you know, the growth of the market about that time really, really accelerated. And this is when Microsoft really started getting on this three-year beat around products. You know, not exactly, but you know, they were revising the product every 3 years or so with a major revision of one sort or another, with the next one being 2003, which again I did a lot of deployments with. It was very popular. This is the time when a lot of people moved off GroupWise and Domino. A lot of people made the change around this time, and it was a relatively easy change back then because, to be quite honest, users were a little bit more tolerant than they are now, and you can get away with a few more not so good experiences. 2007. Now, this is when PowerShell and some redundancy started being built into the product. So rather than relying on operating system functionalities like clustering and things like that, it had its own capability to do HA and disaster recovery, which is a really interesting thing, and it had been a huge investment area since then. So that, again, that's a good thing. It started really fitting into the enterprise, and some of the larger customers really started launching into it at that time. And finally, 2010... I imagine that a lot of the people in the room have dealt with 2010. Again, it's a hugely popular product. It started moving more towards the massively scaled for Office 365 and things like that. So again, huge changes in the product, large incremental changes or reductions in hardware requirement, which is really why I wanted to go through the history. You know, the disk I/O requirements have dropped significantly. You know, as CPU have gone up, it can get more users per server. So a lot of things changed with 2010 that really opened up opportunities for consolidation and centralization. And here we are today, Exchange 2013. There's been a number of sessions here that cover that off. Scott's session on sizing covered off the architecture, so I'm not going to drill into that. I just want to make a few points here which I think are important. The first one I mentioned before, there's two server roles now. So that changes things quite a bit in terms of how you might look at placing it on hardware, or albeit virtual or physical. The dynamics of how they behave is different, where different functions occur is different. And I encourage you to spend a bit of time to look at that. I've got a graphic up shortly, and that's one of the reasons why I brought these big boys along. I'll hand these out at the end. To anyone, you know, beyond answering the questions business. So again, spend some time. This is a downloadable PDF, and I encourage you to spend some time and understand where it is before you start making any large decisions about how you might deploy it. And then things beyond, I think, that really matter around virtualization. You know, the data paths are a lot easier. You know, there's not, if you look at this compared to the 2010 diagram, you'll notice they're significantly different. This is a much easier picture, I think, to look at. Workload management, that's the capability of Exchange to monitor what's going on, and then maybe trimming things back, slowing things down, speeding things up, whatever it is. And that's really a reflection of, you know, messaging now being a 24/7 operation, where before those, a lot of those maintenance things were triggered to happen at 1 a.m. But 1 a.m., it's not 1 a.m. other places in the world, and especially with consolidation, you need to consider that. Improved management tools, you know, gone are the having to install things and all its associated prerequisites and stuff, which I personally think is a great thing. It's now all browser delivered. It's a lot easier to deal with, and a lot easier to give to people as well, you know, at different layers of management. Public folders has changed, which is a good thing. Public folders of old had its own replication mechanism, which I'm sure anyone who dealt with it early on understands that that wasn't an easy thing, and if it broke, it was unbelievably hard to fix. Now that's completely different. It's now mailbox-centric, so it's treated like everything else, like just the normal mailbox. Integration with Link and SharePoint, I won't dwell on that, but again, you've got to consider that. It's talking to other things. It's not just the standalone island of functionality. It's talking to other services within your organisation. And also improvements on high availability and site resilience. And again, there's been a session on that today, and certainly I hope you went to that and learnt something from that, because that does have some considerations with virtual hardware. So here's just a bigger picture of what we saw before. Again, on the yellow side, Scott showed this one last night, so anyone who went to Scott's session would see this. I got really bold and changed the colours just so I wouldn't, you know, separated out. But you can see the two roles over there. So that's CAS and mailbox, and how it's accessed. It's put by, you know, the same front door, basically. So the first question is always, why virtualize? Can anyone give me a good reason why you'd want to virtualize? Why not? So you've read my next slide. Give me a break. So why would you virtualize? One good reason.
Cost.
That's an interesting one. Pardon? Okay, tell me about that. Yep, and certainly from a management point of view, you're right, that makes a difference. Anyone else got one, apart from the one? How do you mean? Yep, quite. So that one's reduced physical servers, and that obviously has effects in the data centre. It certainly reduces real estate, power, aircon. Those things aren't cheap, so it's important to consider that, so that's a good point. One down the back there. Okay, so that's within the platform providing some high availability. Okay, so that's certainly one. You can do that with just normal hardware, by the way. But yeah, good point. One more? Consistency. So what do you mean by that?
Well, everything else that you're running in your data center will most likely be virtualized, so why not virtualize
the chance as well? A poster for you, because that's where I wanted to go with this conversation. So that's something I hear about quite often, and I'm not quite sure about the thinking on that particular point is all that solid, to be honest. Creating consistency is a great thing. Exchange, though, it's not a 2 gig server with 4 cores or whatever. They're usually large servers, you know, and when you overlay that over a lot of virtualized platform, often it's really hard to fit them in. So it's a good point, but you need to consider how it fits. And I've seen situations where, you know, the CAS server design had the same, you know, resource requirements as the VM host. So it was an 8 gig, 2 socket requirement. Well, that was what the VM host was. So that was a one-to-one type relationship. That's not a good fit. So you need to consider all of those things come in. But you're right. And if you've got an environment which is well provisioned, it's got some large servers in it, you know, with, you know, plenty of sockets and plenty much memory in it, you're right, you can do those things. So yeah, but that's a good point. Thank you for that. So why not? Beating me to the punch before. I actually think there's as many reasons why as why not, to be perfectly honest. And the important part here is stop and think about it. You know, I actually think the virtualization first strategy is a reasonable strategy, but often it's not a strategy, it's a tick box. Yes, we're doing that, without a lot of thought about the service that you're providing. So you've got to be a bit careful for that one. So, you know, it does increase complexity. You know, it's going to add other layers. You know, it's unavoidable. The hypervisor is another layer. It's going to require configuration, it's going to require maintenance, it's going to require monitoring. All of those things you need to consider. Not always a bad thing, because sometimes it gives you more insight about what's going on in your machinery, which I think can be a good thing, but it's more things you need to think about. You've got to do more things to deploy it. You know, if you think of it without a virtual, you know, without a hypervisor, you drop your hardware down, put an OS on it, and then you can install your application. With a hypervisor, it's put your hardware down, put the hypervisor on it, and then start loading it up with VMs. So you've got to think about those sorts of things. I think nowadays that's not so big. You know, some of the tools around managing the deployment of virtual machines now are getting pretty smart and pretty quick, but you need to consider, you know, that as a something more that you have to do. Workload mismatch is another one, and this comes back to the point I made before about your answer. Mismatch is a real problem in the virtual environments, because often people stand up big virtual environments for specific reasons around the virtual environment, not necessarily about the applications that live on them. So, for example, they'll have, you know, maybe three types of servers or three sizes, you know, small, medium and large. They all fit together like Lego and everybody's happy. When Exchange comes along and says, well, actually, I need 2 of those Lego bricks, one of them's not quite enough, you have to start thinking again. And then when you've got loads like potentially a big database application, which is thrashing CPU and memory, Exchange just happens to want CPU and memory at the same time, they can butt heads. They're just not really that compatible with each other. And you can do some things around separating them and all of that, but you just need to be aware of that. Virtual sprawl is a good one. I love that phrase, virtual sprawl. Anyone here suffering from virtual sprawl? Everyone smiled when they put their hands up. It's a tough thing. Virtualization, to some extent, has created a lot of expectation around this unlimitless, thing that could just create stuff out of magic, And it's not that. It's a finite resource. You've designed it to do X, but when you want it to do X times 2, it just doesn't go so well. And I've seen instances, one of them, which really shocked me, actually. It was running 2007 on a virtual platform. It was a couple of years ago. But to fire up the admin console for 2007 took the best part of 5 minutes. The mail experience for users was just awful. Do you really want to go there? And that was only caused by virtual sprawl, that people just kept putting things in without any consideration for what else was going on and the total capacity of the platform. And the final one is cost. Someone brought up cost as a good thing. Well, it's a good thing and a bad thing at the end of the day. You can stand up and build out an Exchange platform on commodity physical hardware, I believe, cheaper than you can on virtual. Might not necessarily meet all your requirements, but that's part of the conversation, right? What are your requirements? So, cost is plus and minus. So, there's more to it than just the cost of the machine or the cost of the software. And I certainly encourage you to do some analysis on that if you're making the decision shortly to maybe deploy Exchange 2013. And really understand your total cost view, because sometimes I think you might be surprised. I had a little one a while ago. It was only 1,500 users, not huge, coming off 2003 onto 2010. And by the time we cost it out, it was literally a couple of servers. There was site resilience, so nothing too flash. But we brought a couple of two-socket 32-gig servers with 10 terabytes of storage in each one, which is sufficient to provide the service they require for not a lot of money. The cost of putting it on their SAN with their SAN connectivity costs and HBAs and this, that, and the other thing, it was three times the cost. Again, that was specific to their circumstance. I'm not saying it would be specific to yours. But, I was actually quite surprised about that, because I did have an expectation of, why wouldn't going virtual be cheaper? But it just simply wasn't. So, do the maths. So, ultimately, make sure you know what you're trying to achieve. There is a lot of different ways to achieve a solid platform, a solid Exchange platform on either physical or virtual, but not understanding your options is a crime. You can't make a good decision if you don't know your options. And you also can't make a good decision if you don't know what your objectives are. What are you trying to get out of it? Who here, loaded question, doesn't have an SLA on their Exchange messaging? No SLA. Yeah, that's about what I normally see. And when you think about it, that's not good, but it's not good from the user point of view, because they might not get what they want, which is ultimately where we go with this. But also from a design point of view, how can you make design decisions if you don't know what you're trying to achieve? Because ultimately, things like SLAs around performance, resilience, HA, high availability, and DR, they are directly derived from SLAs. So without knowing them, it makes it very difficult to really get a good outcome. So just be aware of that. And the final point I want to make with this is make sure you're going to get something out of it. If you're not going to get anything out of it, why would you do it? So be clear about what you're getting out of it. What are the advantages you're trying to get out of it? What is it? Is it, things like high availability of machines? Is it about, a good path to your data? Whatever it is, just make sure you're going to get that. Because I think sometimes people lose sight of that and they do it for the sake of doing it. And then it's like, if you're anything like me, whenever I go buy a new car, I want all the bells and whistles. I go and buy all the bells and whistles and pay way too much. Everyone does that, I think. And then you drive it away and it's like, whatever, So I've got all these dials in front of me. I never look at them. It's one of those sort of scenarios. So just make sure you know what you want to get out of it. So what do you need to think about? So there's a whole bunch of things you need to think about. The first thing I'm going to look at is sizing, because the rules are slightly different. I just want to go through that. Scott last night went through sizing, covered it all off. The process that he talked about is actually no different for virtualization. There's just a few extra things you need to think about. So the first, you know, like I said, you follow the process that Scott talked through. It's the same process. You know, work out what your requirements are, look at your speeds and feeds, bring all those things in and go through the design process using the role requirements calculator. It's certainly the best way to go. It is a very mature tool. I know it's been put together by some pretty smart people who really understand that. They are looking at the performance of Exchange all the time. So just, you know, use that process. But you do have to take into account the fact that virtualization isn't free. There is a 10% or thereabouts hit across the top, the fact that you've got a hypervisor in there. And also take into account the impact of shared virtual infrastructure. Other things, other applications, other servers are going to be consuming resources if you're going onto a shared platform. So out of the people who have installed 2013, who went on to a shared platform? You know, you're sharing it with other things, other applications. Yep, no surprise. That's why you do it, right? So were they big applications or just ones that spin? Okay, which is fair enough. Okay, that's one of the motivations behind doing it, which is great. But yeah, have you ever run into the situation where another application has impinged upon Exchange's ability to work?
Not recently.
Love that answer, not recently. So it has happened. So yeah, it's just something to think about. And when you're designing it, you know, just take that into account. Exchange is very specific about its requirements. So just be aware of those and use the tools to help you do that. But a couple of points about the role requirements calculator, though. Look at your assumptions. Check your assumptions. They are only assumptions, unless you've got some pretty hard data that you've collected. But just test those assumptions. And the other thing I encourage you to do with that tool, because you can change things and say, oh, if I go this way, if I go that way, what's it going to look like? Spend some time and do that. Understand what happens when you change certain parameters. Because I think you'll be quite surprised about how you can either bring things in or take things out based on what sort of hardware capability you've got. So spend a bit of time. I encourage you to do that and try different, you know, different options and different combinations of things. But make sure you do set the values that ensure that it takes into account for the hypervisor. So there's two settings I've mentioned there. The first one is just saying, yes, take into account I'm going to be on a hypervisor, and the second one is what that impact is. So as I said before, it's about 10% for Hyper-V. On a highly tuned, you know, late model server that has all the bells and whistles in it around running a hypervisor, I've been told you can get down to about 6% impact, which, you know, in certain circumstances, which is pretty good, I think. You know, especially if you're thinking about 100 machines, that is actually quite a lot of horsepower you're considering there, to about 12, depending on the circumstances. So stick with 10 for Hyper-V, and talk to your, if you're using another vendor's hypervisor, talk to them. They have very solid guidance around this stuff. So certainly, if you're a Xen or a VMware user, check with them and get that feedback from them about what you should use, and then plug that into the calculator. That's a very, very important thing to do. 10% might not sound like much, but based on your assumptions, it could push you over a particular line that you don't want to cross. So just watch out for that. Memory is not usually a big problem. You know, modern servers typically have a lot of memory in them. They're NUMA-based servers. And you can certainly leverage NUMA. Exchange doesn't know about NUMA. It doesn't care for it. But the operating system might, and there are certainly some new things in Windows Server 2012, for example, that respect NUMA and maximise the effect of NUMA. So if your operating system can deal with that, Exchange over the top sort of gets advantage from it, but not directly. So again, look at those. Server 2012, NUMA is in the guests now, so there's some great things you can do there. From a storage point of view, there's sort of two points there. You know, design for latency and high availability. Why do we want to do that? Because latency directly affects the user experience. We all care about that. And then high availability is the data at the end of the day is your crown jewels. You need to guard and protect that and make sure it doesn't go away, because I don't know if anyone here has ever had a catastrophic failure and lost all their mail or lost a large portion. Anyone brave enough to put their hand up? Ooh, couple. Now, was that a great experience? Were you the most popular guy in town? No. So my advice to you is don't be that guy. It's not a good place to be. I've been involved in circumstances where data has been lost, and it's just not a good thing, especially in today's environment of compliance and all of those sorts of things, you know, not good. So, you know, from a disk point of view, spend a bit of time. But also, too, the other thing with most virtualized environments now, it typically backs onto some pretty big storage for one reason or another. So the storage layers typically are more complicated. So be aware of the complications that will bring you and account for it if you need to. You know, a lot of talk around storage nowadays, oh, it's so big, it caches everything, it's all transparent. And yes, I've heard that 1,000 times before. However, where do you typically have problems with Exchange? With storage. So, you know, take a bit of time, make sure you understand the performance characteristics of your storage, where the high availability is, where the paths are, and just make sure you think about it, because again, that complicating factor will kick you if you're not careful. But one of the cool things about hypervisors is its flexibility around networking. There's a lot of choices now in VMware, Hyper-V, especially with System Center, around how you might present the network to Exchange and then transport that to your users. Some great options. In the past, you know, you might have a two-socket server, it might have a dual-port card in it, you know, network card, and often you'd be forced to put in, say, a quad card or another dual card. You know, that's all extra cost. With virtualization, you don't have to do that because you can create virtual NICs and virtual networks. You've got a lot of choices there. So I certainly encourage you to look at those and take advantage of it because it just makes sense, right? It's a cheaper approach than buying physical cards and things. So look out for that. And again, look at the availability. If your users can't get to your data because the network's down, as far as they're concerned, it's broken. You know, you might say, oh, my Exchange server's up, my availability is good, but if no one's logged on to it, it's pretty useless. So just watch out for that and make sure that you account for that in your design. So in general, with sizing, you know, it's the same as for physical, but just remember to take that 10% off top. And a good way to sort of visualize that, if you like, if you have your machine like that, and you've got your virtual machines consuming resources, it's that little layer across the top, which is the overhead that you need to think about. That's not magic. It's going to get consumed one way or another. All right, co-location. I've already mentioned this a bit. This is an area where I've seen a lot of people get stuck. A couple of reasons for that. Some workloads are just incompatible. And typically, it's Exchanges that's incompatible because it's big, it requires a lot of resources, it's going to use them as soon as users start logging on. It's going to consume the memory, it's going to consume the resource and everything else around it. That will affect other things, but then again, you might have a big application which then thumps Exchange. Look at those things. Understand those things within the context of the dynamic nature of your virtual platform. You know, remembering, of course, that the guys who run the virtual platforms, their objectives may not be the same as yours. You know, your objective is to provide a highly available, performing mail service. That's our job. Their job is to optimize the use of hardware, albeit network, CPU, or memory, or whatever, and provide high availability and things like that. They're not necessarily aligned. Christian? Good question. In real life, I have. I'm actually going to talk about that shortly, not in a lot of detail. So the question was, any experience with presenting storage to Exchange over iSCSI, which is a pretty common thing nowadays. But you know, I would say I'll talk about that shortly. But the real recommendations there, it's all about throughput. You know, if you can do that on large pipes, and to make sure you're not dealing with latency or whatever, you know, that makes really good sense. But trying to have a good experience on a smaller network? No. So it's pretty straightforward. A lot of it depends on the iSCSI stack you're using and what's in your guest. So yeah, there's quite a few parameters, but it's quite easy to tune. But you know, I know this sounds a bit sad, but on my network at home, I actually have an iSCSI optimized switch, so I don't have to think about a lot of those things. It just does it. It goes, oh, there's some iSCSI and optimizes it for me.
So your preference would be to have the actual mailbox storage presented by, say, NFS or SMB3?
I'll definitely cover that because some of those things are good and some of them aren't. But yeah, I'll get to that one. So the question was, you know, looking at NFS or SMB3. So I will cover that shortly, and perhaps after the session we could take it offline and drill down on that a bit more if it makes sense. But well, I am going there with this conversation, but good point. So as I said before, with Exchange, it is a big app. We all know that. I've said it a few times. And the main thing is you've got to make sure it gets what it needs. So reserving the resources for it is a good way to do that. Because in that big shared environment with the virtualization guys having a slightly different objective than yours, they might go, ooh, things are getting a bit tight here. Oh, there's this big application over there. Does it really need all those resources? And they might crank them down. And then Exchange comes along and you introduce another couple of hundred mailboxes with UM features enabled, and all of a sudden it's really struggling to deliver good performance. And or they move it to a host which has got different types of CPUs on it. There's a number of scenarios that you need to account for. Resource allocation is a good way to get some, you know, lock-in around that. And at the end of the day, you know, we all know that virtualization is a great platform for those applications, the occasional use applications, you know, the back-end spinning low-end database application, the logging server. We know it's great for those because they don't have that high demand. They're just sitting there ticking away, and you can definitely share those. So, you know, take the opportunity to look at those workloads and fit them around the big workloads as best you can. And that's when you maximize the hardware. So good practice, don't overcommit. That's when things aren't going to go it's good. You need a responsive system, so don't overcommit. And reserve them, reserve that information, you know, reserve that resource for them. And if you do that, you'll be in pretty safe hands, I think. All right, so a couple of final things about getting a bit carried away. You know, avoid excessive scaling. Obviously, that was the point I made before about the console starting slowly. If you just keep ramming things into it, there's a point where it's just not going to be flash. So just be aware of that, watch it, don't get too carried away. And also the second point there about modern hypervisors, you can really stack them up with a lot of things. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Just be aware of that, don't overcommit too many resources, and just make sure that you're getting a maximum effect out of both Exchange and the virtual hardware it's sitting on. But also from a mailbox service point of view, they're the big one, if you like. They're the ones who are going to consume the most resource. Make sure you don't get too many on one host. You know, a blade, two-socket blade with a couple of mailbox servers on, you know, might not be a good combination, depending on your platform, of course. So just look out for that and certainly talk to your virtualization management guys to make sure that those servers don't bump and end up on the same host. Again, it could turn off performance a bit, and just watch out for that. So a good approach is a couple of mailbox servers per physical and then spread the mailbox servers out through your environment. Because you know, I've seen recently situations where just through the dynamicness of the virtual platform, all of the Exchange servers have ended up on one host. It's fair to say that wasn't a flash circumstance, especially since all of their DAG copies were also on that host. So a host failure was a total failure. And you'll laugh, but you'll be surprised how often that happens. A few years ago, I saw a 7-node cluster, and no one was really paying much attention to it, and all of the Exchange instances and databases were on one. It failed. They lost all their data. So, yeah, it's serious stuff, but it's kind of funny, too, because when you see that. It's more funny because I didn't do it, but, you know, somebody else did, so you can always have a bit of a laugh. And again, burn up the remaining capacity with the lower end, less important, less resource intensive workloads. So that's on sizing. Again, I'll just remind you that Scott's session covered this off in a lot more detail than I have. I've just tried to focus on the things related to virtualization. The next area is around supportability. And this has been a really difficult one for a whole bunch of reasons. When virtualization first started becoming popular, certain vendors made all sorts of claims about what it was and what it wasn't, what it could do and what you could do with Microsoft products. At the end of the day, Microsoft makes some pretty solid support statements around their products now, and you need to follow those. So watch out for that. It can catch you out. I had a number of customers who started using some migration technologies with Exchange 2003. That just didn't go well, and they lost data. So just be aware, watch out for that sort of thing. So I'm going to go through some of the support statements that Microsoft make, how you can find out where to get that information from. So what is supported with Exchange 2013? Those up on the screen. So obviously the later versions of Microsoft Service server products are all there. And the last one there around the SVPP. So that's a certification process that Microsoft has. I'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. So these are all pretty obvious, so that's good to know. So both roles. It was funny last night, Scott was having a look at my deck and I had all roles. There's only two, so I swapped it to both. So they're all supported on virtualized platforms, which is great. In the past, some roles weren't, which was interesting, but they weren't for good reason, but now you don't have to worry about that. You can boots and all with Exchange. Storage, the story on storage hasn't really changed much. There's some new capability in Server 2012, which I'll talk about in a minute. But basically, you're still wanting to present block-level storage. That hasn't changed forever. And then the other requirements are really the same as Exchange 2010. So most people should be familiar with that. So whatever you're thinking is, you can carry it straight through to 2013. Host-based clustering. Does anyone do any host-based clustering with Exchange at all, any version? No one. Wow, I'm really surprised about that. Because that was pretty common for a long time, so that's that's really interesting. So again, both roles are supported, no real constraint there. Migration, so that's live migration or vMotion. So they're both supported. Which is great because that gives you some flexibility and buys you some of the reasons why you do virtualization, which I think is great. And the last one is around jet stressing. So those who aren't aware of jet stress, it's a tool that Microsoft provides for hammering your storage to make sure it can, has the characteristics that you think you need to deliver a good service with Exchange. In the past, that wasn't so good running in a virtual machine, just because some of the performance counters that it used to gauge that performance were a little variable inside a virtual machine. So that's all been ironed out now. So you can do that quite easily now, which is good, because you should certainly validate your storage every single time. And that's for two reasons. One, the one I said before, which is making sure Exchange gets what it wants, but certainly to measure the effect on the other things on your system. It always cracks me up whenever I've done a jet stress, I've asked a customer, I'd like to do it mid-morning, please. And they go, whoa, you can't do that. I said, well, when we deploy in a week's time, we'll be doing that. So, yeah, try to get it as close to real life as possible. So just circling back around to the SVPP, that is a really important resource, not just for Exchange, it's actually for all products that can sit on hypervisors, Microsoft products or Microsoft-related products sitting on hypervisors. So it's a really important resource, and I certainly encourage you to go and have a look at it. When you're going through a design process, and quite a few of you said you design Exchange systems, you should be visiting that beforehand, and just making sure that you're selecting supported options, and then also it links you through to this, which is the Exchange supportability page. So this is on TechNet. I've got a link in the back of the deck for that to help you find that if you've never seen it before. It is pretty black and white what is and isn't supported, and I certainly encourage you to spend a bit of time and get your head around that because it will help you in your design processes. So I thought I'd just sort of pop off a little bit to the side and just talk about some of the new things that have come in Windows Server 2012. A huge product, lots of new things, lots of new features, especially with Hyper-V. So I'm not going to drill into all of those. There's server sessions and other ways to find that out. But from a virtual server, from an Exchange point of view, I think the most important thing there is because of the scale changes, it took away a lot of the blockers that Exchange used to have. The four core, or the four virtual CPU blocker, really limited what you could do. From a mailbox server point of view, that really shrinks down how many users you can support on that. That limit is gone now. So it should be a much easier decision to look towards going on to Hyper-V for Exchange. I love that next statement there. But the secret behind that one is the Exchange team and the Hyper-V team within Windows Server Group, they work very closely together. They are very well aligned. The Exchange team tests thousands of servers every day, and they have this closed loop feedback loop with the Hyper-V team. So they work very closely together. So that experience is the best experience, not to say other hypervisors won't give you good, because they will. But in terms of testing and reliability and all of those other abilities that you care about, you know, that alignment, I think, brings a terrific amount of value that you shouldn't discount. So an important thing. So there is some do's and don'ts, and we've already talked about those, so we'll come back to some of those towards the end. But I popped this in yesterday, actually, when I was reviewing the slide deck, because I just thought it was quite interesting. You know, when you look at the improvement over the other side across these various things here, some of those are quite extraordinary numbers, and they will certainly create opportunity for you. So I just popped that in there just as a matter of interest, so because maybe you hadn't spotted that before. So this is coming to this gentleman's point before about storage. There is some new storage considerations with Windows Server 2012, and that's SMB3. So SMB3 is a new file share version, if you like, of SMB, and I've got a bit of talk about that in a minute. But you can now present shares to Exchange, to Hyper-V servers to mount or to save, the virtual machines on SMB shares, which is an interesting choice. I don't know if it's for everybody, but it's a relatively cost-effective way to put some resilience at a file system level and still be supported. A couple of things there, though. you're still presenting those VHDs in the Hyper-V. You're not just making a share available to Exchange. It's not that at all. It's it's a virtual machine level thing. So you might have a VHD or VHDX file that's sitting on an SMB3 share, and that's your Exchange server. You might have its data related on another SMB share if that's what you decide to do. But again, it's at the Hyper-V level that you're getting those exposed. So it gives you an opportunity to create some more resilience in your file system without having to get shared copy clusters and all of those sorts of things involved. So, just another choice in that. So there's a bit of a chat here. I'm not going to drill into this. There's another session on SMB3, and I'm not sure if it's happened yet, but if it hasn't, I encourage you to go to it just to get a better feel for what it can do. But the graphics along the bottom are interesting. Just some examples where you've got a file server across the bottom here, and you've got two Hyper-V parents, and the virtual machines are sitting on the shares rather than direct attached disk. The middle one is just where you've got a cluster involved and you've got it slightly more complicated. It gives you a higher level of file resilience, if you like. And on the far side, that's really talking about some type of SAN solution with multipathing and all of that sort of thing. Like I said, I'm not going to drill in on those. The other session will cover that. But, from an Exchange point of view, it's another choice, another option that is relatively cost-effective and easy to implement. So this is answering the question before about NFS. And I actually get asked this one quite a bit, and so I thought I'd spend a bit of time in it. The biggest problem with NFS is performance and variability of performance. There's a lot of implementations or versions of NFS. So, it creates a lot of challenges, reliability, all of those things come into it. And at the end of the day, there are better choices. So Microsoft just has decided not to focus on NFS just because of the variability in what it is. So they've really stayed away from that. That's not to say you can't do certain things with VMware and such under the covers, but from an Exchange point of view, the data has to sit on NTFS or REFS. Another one I often get asked, and this one creates a lot of confusion, and some of it is the hype, if you like, no pun, around other vendors, about what they promise, what they say, what they support, and all of that. And it caused a lot of confusion in the early days, and as I said before, people did some things that, you know, weren't that good. The bottom line is Microsoft does support things like live migration or equivalent like vMotion. They absolutely support that. And there's a reason why they support that, because when the machine's coming back, when it's been failed over, it's coming up from a cold start. It's not a warm swap. It's not a replicated swap in that regard. And what they don't support is the quick migration where the state is saved, moved, and stood up again. They don't support that. So is everyone okay with that? I think most people should be okay with that now. It's, that message has been out there for a couple of years now, so I kind of think people should be across that. An interesting one on the save state one, and all of you who run labs, and you know, you reboot a host, but weren't thinking too hard, and then it, and you've got it configured to save state. That's the same thing. You're stopping time, and then when you bring that up from a save state, you could crunch your data. So you need to be careful of that and make sure your virtual machines are set to shut down. So when you bring your host back up, they come up properly. And the last question I often get is about NAS. And this has been a forever question, and it's not block level storage typically, so therefore it's just not supported. I had a customer a few years ago who decided that they needed to use NAS, which is good on them, but you know, 3 or 4 times out of 10, every time they would dismount a database, it would just corrupt, which pushed them straight into a DR situation, and they did it for about a year before they thought, gee, this is a bad idea, and I'm going, that just makes my head explode. But, you know, just don't go there. But where it does come in is with the iSCSI. If you've got a guest, you know, you can connect to iSCSI-based storage. But there are certain network drivers within certain hypervisors. There are limitations. Like, I can't remember which one right now, but one of them doesn't support Jumbo frames. Well, Jumbo frames is kind of handy with iSCSI, so just watch out if there's any limitations in there that may impinge on the performance that you're looking for, because remember that in iSCSI, it's the disk performance that's important. Alrighty, there's a few things that aren't supported. I've already talked about one of those, but the big ticket item here is dynamic memory, or memory overcommit, or whatever you want to call it. All vendors have a slightly different name for it. I'm going to stick to dynamic or static memory. That's the Hyper-V naming for it. You've really got to fix that to static. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. But the main one is Exchange is pretty dynamic. It is a very changeable system, you know, with mail usage, profiles, routing, all the things that it does. No minute is the same as the previous minute. It's completely dynamic. If you're in a situation where you might be idling a bit, you know, everyone's gone to lunch, and the hypervisor goes, oh, great, I need some of that resource that Exchange has got, that memory, and it just takes it away. The load comes back on Exchange and it goes, I need these resources. There might be a lag, they might not be available, whatever, but it's bad for Exchange. So just be very careful about your memory configuration. Follow the guidance around the amount of memory you should be allocating for the two different roles, and make sure that, you know, that they're in those parameters, because that will give you the best experience. And that, again, referring back to Scott's session from last night. Correct. So, good point. So I'll just refer back again to that page that I showed before. That is all on that page in detail. So again, I encourage you to go there. That is the support statement. Snapshots. We all love to do snapshots. I certainly use them a lot in my labs. Again, snapshots is about saving in time. They're just not supported. You know, log shipping and distributed replication and things just don't like stopping one machine, snapshotting it in time, then bringing it back later. It's just not a good thing. So just watch out for that, and don't do it. Differencing disks and Delta disks, they are snapshotting to one way or another, so yeah, they're not supported either. And then this is really a Hyper-V specific option or item. you know, don't run applications on the parent partition. It's just going to consume resources that you'd rather be spending with your virtual machines. All the normal ones, like your maybe your system center clients and antivirus, and all that usual stuff is fine. But, you know, dropping a SQL instance on it, for example, probably isn't that clever. So, you know, don't do that. And this is another one, which again is one of those things that sometimes slips out of your control as an Exchange administrator, and that's the process over subscription. It's, you know, supported with 2-to-1, but it's highly recommended that it's 1-to-1. And the reason for that is when you go through your design with your role guide, your role calculator, you know, it works on megacycles. It does calculations based on your inputs, but it all comes down to megacycles at the end of the day. If it says it needs 1 million megacycles, whatever number, it needs 1 million. If you take that away, or say you can only have 500,000 today, it's going to perform badly. It's just the reality of the situation. So I would certainly encourage you to go to 1-to-1 if that's what you think you need. If you have enough slack in the platform that you think you'll get that most of the time anyway, it's probably okay to run with that, but that you need to keep an eye on that. Alrighty, one last thing just about replica. That's a new feature in 2012 where you can replicate VMs between hosts, and that's a really interesting, great system, and I certainly use it, but I don't use it for Exchange because I just don't want to have breakage in there, and that's pretty much for the same reason around snapshotting. At the end of the day, Exchange has its own capability for doing that, the DAG. So, you know, use the inbuilt features if that's what you want. Don't try and do it at a virtual machine level. You'll end up in trouble. And then also things like Azure and AWS and those sort of platforms, they just don't have the grunt necessary to run Exchange. Has anyone done that? Like, I read somebody the other day, they gave it a go and it was pretty ordinary. Have you seen anyone do that, Scott? Yeah. 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 Wow, that's interesting. Yeah. It's still not supported. Yeah, yeah.
Well, when we say that, it's not supported by Microsoft.
Yeah.
Amazon obviously is stepping up to support that solution.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you had a problem with the underlying Exchange data, you would only get best effort support from us.
And that's tough when you've got the CEO on your back. Yeah. But yeah, so it may put you in a place where you don't want to be. So, you know, to be quite honest, the not supported list over time is getting smaller. The difference between virtual and physical now is getting smaller, which is a really great thing. So I'd assume some of these things will be changing over time. So keep an eye out. All righty. So I've got a question for one of these bad boys. Who can tell me what SVVP stands for? No H in it. No, you're not allowed to. Not allowed to. So I think you spoke first. Nope. There's one over here. One down here. Oh, come on. And? No. Okay, exactly right. I'll tell you what, I think a couple of people got that. I have a few of these. So there you go. Don't have too much fun with that. Only read it. Yeah. There you go, Bom. Yeah, really? You just pass it over. Yeah, and just a reminder about it, and I don't want to sound like a scratch record. No, you have to keep watching me still. Don't do that. Mm. It is a really important thing. Microsoft invest a lot of time and effort, and so do the other product and hypervisor vendors as well. So pay attention. One little thing you've got to be really careful with is that when a vendor releases a hypervisor, there may be a version release or some such. There may be a gap before it appears on SVVP. So that gap is a gap of unsupported. So just be aware, you might be okay with that, but just remember that gap, you, wait for that time if you can, because otherwise you might end up in that, can you put that on a supported platform conversation? And yeah, so watch out. I think that's happened a couple of times, hasn't it, where vendors have been a bit slow. So be careful of that. All right, problem areas. We've talked a little bit about co-location and distribution. I want to talk about that a little bit more because, and again, I don't want to be a scratch record, but this is an area that I see happening all the time. So again, we want to avoid it in terms of getting too much on the same host. So you really need to look at it in a bigger picture in terms of failure domains. Exchange sits on top of a lot of other things. And from a user point of view, you know, typically what I hear from users, my Outlook is broken. That's their perspective. They don't care whether it's the piece of wire between their desktop and the wall or a disk has crashed in the data center. They don't understand that. We understand that. So we need to understand all the failure domains that support Exchange delivering its service. That's a very important thing. There's no point having a highly available Exchange system if your network is single-pathed and rubbish reliability. The outcome is the same from the user point of view. So you need to be aware of those and look at all of those things. In a virtual environment, that's just created some more of those you need to consider. So just watch out for that and just be aware of it. And you know, if you don't, you could get burnt. And the main thing there is, and this is the bit I love, especially about infrastructure management folks, they don't understand failure. You know, stuff breaks. It's going to happen. It's unavoidable. It's either that or human error, one or the other. So just design for it. It's not a big deal. Exchange is designed to be highly available in the right configuration and provide DR in the application layer. It's there. Use it. Don't necessarily rely on all those other tools and, you know, virtualization, replication, and all that other stuff. Don't rely on it. You know, Exchange can do it by itself. So just let the application do it. It knows its data. It knows what it's doing. So, you know, understanding those failure domains. The next one is kind of funny as well. That's the story I told before about all the database copies ending up on one host or one piece of storage. Pretty common. I've seen that by design, you know, not by an operational error, but by design, and it's not very clever. So, you know, try not to do that because it just never ends well. But also some of the dependencies as well. Active Directory, for example. If you've got your Active Directory servers sitting on the same host, virtual host, as Exchange, and you have a host failure, you know, again, you've just lost something that's kind of important for bringing Exchange back, Active Directory, or DNS. So just be aware of those, spread them out when you can, and just be aware that their contribution to the success of Exchange is pretty large. So watch out for those things as well. Again, pretty obvious, but I'm sure you can cope with that. Storage, so these are the basic bread and butter storage guidance for Exchange. They are pretty simple, they're easy to get wrong, but allocating enough storage for guests, while we might go, yeah, that's really funny, that's easy to do, it's easy to get wrong, like an operating system upgrade, for example, not that you could do that Exchange live, can increase the requirement for that virtual machine storage. And there's also the storage within the virtual machine, within the guest. Exchange installs some other things now. It's doing additional logging. That all has storage impact, both from an IOP and a capacity point of view. You need to account for those. They are accounted for in the storage calculator, so just keep an eye on that. Don't share spindles. Sounds like it's sort of something else, doesn't it? It's a finite resource, so don't share spindles with the host operating system. Use the supported disk configurations, we've talked about those, and fix the size of the VHD or VHDXs. There's been a bit of chat about that recently, but from a support point of view, that's the supported point of view, fixed size, not variable or growing. Host-based clustering is a good one. I was, like I said before, I asked about that. No one did it. It's very interesting that people don't do that. They are typically more complicated, but they do give you some benefits that you may want to consider around hardware redundancy, network redundancy. You can lose a host because it's using shared copy or whatever. It can easily move over. That's a fully supported scenario, but it's only really protecting against hardware failure. You know, you often get that inherent in your virtual environment anyway, but there's some interesting things there. Couple of things. Exchange doesn't know about it. It doesn't know about Exchange. So combining that with a DAG gives you a pretty good solid foundation for doing that. That's a good thing. Data corruption is the thing that you need to look out for. So your DAG design should account for that. This will not deal with that. If a disk goes bad, it's corruption, and you need to deal with it within the other constraint, the other capabilities you've got. So again, if you're going to do it, include it with a DAG. So nobody's doing it at the moment, so that's cool. Memory. We've talked about dynamic memory. I just want to jump through this slide a bit and just show you an interesting diagram here. So the green line is available bytes. There's a situation where dynamic memory's been configured. The hypervisor's gone, oh great, I need a couple of gigs of RAM, I'm going to take it from this Exchange server. And you can see the RPC latency starts spiking. Who can tell me why we care about that? Why do we care about RPC latency? Yes. Exactly, that's the client. It's the direct measure of the client experience. So, such a great answer, you can have one of these. Can you just pass that back for us, mate? So, you know, it is the client experience, and you've got to watch out for it. What's causing that is that the database cache is either coming out of the swap file, in other words, it's hitting the disk, and that's often the OS disk, so it's going to smash that, or it really compresses the cache size, so it's having to do more work to maintain that. So that's a pretty, you know, if you were a user on the end of that, you would know. So watch out for that. This one here is about the clustering piece. You've got to be mindful that clustering swapovers, changeovers take time. In a DAG scenario, if it goes beyond 5 seconds, that node may be evicted from the DAG because it's gone beyond that. So that brownout time is very important, and you need to, when you go through your testing, your load testing, you want to make sure that when you do a swap that it's within that. If it's not, you need to adjust those two parameters at the bottom. So that's relatively straightforward. So that's 1,000 milliseconds times 5, so that's the 5 seconds I talked about. If you need to increase that, you just change one of those to reflect that. Relatively straightforward. But what it does suggest is you need to test that, you need to be aware of that, and you need to monitor that, because if you're in a situation where you're getting DAG nodes being evicted all the time, that's going to drive you to have to maybe do other things like reseeds or whatever, other operational functions that you have to do. You don't want to do that. So again, monitor that, make sure you're right, and make sure you get that. But don't have that too long, because then you can get into trouble at the other end of the scale. So just be careful of that. Scott talked about that a bit last night as well. So there's no such thing as a TARDIS. Can anyone tell me what a TARDIS is? What it stands for? Over here? Close. Anyone else? You've already got a poster. Brilliant. Okay, come and get your poster. I thought that was quite funny when I looked that up. I bounced it off Scott last night, and Scott goes, a what?
No.
Oh, no, I bounced it off Andrew, sorry. Yeah, it was Andrew, sorry. Yeah, total nerd. Yeah. And this is really about the snapshotting piece. I've got 5 minutes, so I'll start speeding up. And that's, you know, you just can't save time. If you snapshot or save a state of a machine when you've got maybe transactions in flight, you've got log files firing back and forth, if you're going to do that, you know, the coordination required to do that over a distributed environment is significant. You know, the timing for it to occur could be significant, and you just can't pull that time back. You know, so again, don't go there with that. There's a reason why it's not supported. You could break yourself quite quickly. Question back here? That all versions, yes. Another question? Excellent question, poster for you. As you can see, we're getting near the end and I still have a pile. So the entry level is very low. No insult, honest. Yeah, you're right. VSS is still supported for backups, but again, it's a timing issue. VSS backups over large data sets within your hardware can still take a bit of time, so you need to be aware. Ouch. Wow. I would hope not. Yeah. Yeah. So Scott was just saying it. You know, you're in that state until you get a clean shutdown. It's always in that state. So yeah. You know, I need to speed up. Maybe we can talk after. So. The CPU point I've covered there. There's no magic with CPU. They're finite resources in a server. So, you know, the overcommit thing and hoping for the best is just not a good approach. Watch out for that. Make sure you've allocated. Again, I've talked that one to death a bit because it's really important. You really need to focus on that. And I really need to speed up. So I'll just jump that one and go straight to the wrap-up. What fantastic timing. So again, virtualizing Exchange is completely supported with a few limitations. That's a good thing. You've got a lot of options, you know, a lot of options. Make sure you understand them. And I'm sure you all do. You know, it's just a matter of reading through some of this stuff, making sure you understand the support model, what's supported, what's not. You know, do the right thing. It's not always the right choice. I made that point at the top of the talk. There's physical server choices. I gave an example about using commodity boxes. And at the end of the day, that's a design parameter for Exchange. Two core, you know, commodity servers with commodity SATA and SATA disks, and that's what it's designed for. You can get a great solution by doing that and using the DAG technologies and some of the other things as well to create a cost-effective solution. Just don't discount it, is really what I'm saying. Don't oversubscribe, we've talked about that. And there are certain things in certain hypervisors that just aren't well suited to this type of platform. Just so, you know, most of those were in that unsupported list, so just watch out for those and be aware of those. And then, you know, I think you'll create a great platform to support Exchange and obviously deliver a great service to your customers. So I have a few other quick things here. So here's some links which I hope you'll find useful. The role guide calculator up top, be aware that that gets updated from time to time. So always revisit every time you do a new design, go there again, get the latest copy. It's got all the latest smarts built into it. The SVPP program, the great technical articles on virtualizing Exchange. That server for IT pros is a great document, and then so is the best practice one. Lots of interesting things in there, which I think you'll find useful. And the Exchange team blog, which is really one of the better places to go. It's quite current, it gets there quite quickly. And that, again, have a look in there, you'll find some very good things. There's some other sessions. There was Scott's from last night. I'm sorry for talking quickly now. High availability and site resilience, again, from Scott, great sessions. You should have a look at those. If you didn't go to them, download the recordings. They'll be very useful. And then I just popped that SMB3 in there just because I think that's an interesting choice for some people and worth a look if you're deploying Server 2012 platforms. Find me later. I'm going to be kicking around. I'm happy that you tap me on the shoulder and ask me hard questions. I will respond in two ways. The first one is, it depends. I'm a consultant. That's what I say. The second one is, which some people got out the door early, is, yes, I have a million answers. Some of them are right. So anyway, tap me on the shoulder. Happy to talk. I talk a lot. Here are some other things here from the track. Take a look at those. There's some fantastic IP in there that will help you be successful in deploying, designing and deploying Exchange. So I think, how much time have we got on time? Any questions? 2 minutes. Yes. So some of that is bound by the virtualization platform. So I typically don't look at it like that. I look at it, say, from a commodity point of view. The two-socket, it's designed for two-socket systems. So that's my starting point. And I typically don't have to go beyond that, to be honest. Normally, often in the past, I've been constrained by the virtual platform, so that makes me make certain decisions. But I think it's finding that balance between the numbers of servers you've got and the configuration of them. Sorry, is that an okay answer? Or?
Yeah, I just wanted, like, obviously before they used to actually say don't go above 4 CUs, and they have taken that limit away.
Yeah.
Now, so I just kind of wanted to still find him at this
point. Mm. Well, again, I think it's... sorry. Great question. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. Don't forget to do the reviews. I always like people's feedback. And thanks again, and I might see you tonight. Ask me a question. You know the answers. Anyone wants a poster, please come up and help yourself. I've got quite a few here.